On our podcast today, we are going to be talking with the author of The Pooh Perplex, a wonderful takeoff on Winnie the Pooh, and then Postmodern Pooh, which shows what the postmoderns would have done as critical writers to Winnie the Pooh. But we're not talking about Winnie the Pooh because Frederick Cruz has another interest which has possessed him in recent years. You are essentially a disabused former psychoanalytic fan. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yes, I can't deny it.
In a way, you've lost the faith. But the faith as you acquired it was being commonly acquired by people like you, that is to say, professors of English and literature in American universities.
That's absolutely right. You know, from about the 1950s into the 70s, Freudianism was becoming a popular cultural phenomenon in the academic world, and I participated in that.
So you confess your guilt?
Well, I confess my guilt, but I would like to blame some others, chiefly Ernest Jones for his biography of Freud in the 50s, which was extremely seductive and is just gradually turning out to have been largely fictional.
Another reverential biography of Freud was done by a professor of English, or at least of comparative literature, at Yale University.
That's right. Peter Gay, 1988, mm-hmm. Yale. It was called Freud, A Biography for Our Time. And I think what Gay meant by for our time is that serious doubts were being voiced mm-hmm. about Freud in the 1980s, and his book is essentially a kind of counter-revolution against them.
Let me set a general theme as we begin. In a famous passage, Freud lists three scientists who have, as he sees it, disturbed mankind by diminishing the uniqueness and the dominance of mankind. And those three are Copernicus, Darwin, and then, conquering his natural modesty, himself. Freud is the third. One basic difference, however, between these three great disturbers is that Copernicus and Darwin were basically right in their discoveries, while many, including certainly you, now argue that not only was Freud wrong, he was a falsifier, perhaps even a charlatan. Do you go that far?
I would go that far, and I would point out that Darwin didn't need to say there was a big revolution before me, and Copernicus and I are the two big guys now. That was Freud's self-propaganda, and that's really what he did throughout his career.
But it was his way of noting that psychoanalysis brought a lot of opposition, a lot of persecution almost in Vienna, so he asserted, and in general, worldwide rejection because it got to unpalatable or disturbing truths which people couldn't face. Was that, in fact, the reaction to Freud?
Let me say, Milt, that this couldn't be more wrong.
Yeah.
You know, Freud wrote to his friend Fleece when he started grilling all of his patients about their sex lives, and he said, "Boy, this sex stuff is really great. Everybody goes for it. They love it. They want to hear more about it." And, you know, when psychoanalysis became fashionable early in the 20th century, people flocked to it because it seemed so sexually advanced. Freud could hardly get rid of these people who wanted to turn him into a great authority. So it was exactly the opposite of the world rejecting psychoanalysis because of its emphasis on sex. Everybody loves sex. And that was the main thing that attracted people to psychoanalysis.
But when you acknowledge that you essentially view Freud as pretty close to being a charlatan, some astonished listeners and those who are listening to this podcast might very well respond by arguing with some intensity, wrong as a scientist and a liar to boot? How can you say that? How dare you, sir, say that of Sigmund Freud when he was such a benefactor of mankind?
Well, you're throwing in wrong as a writer. Actually, Freud as a rhetorician was quite brilliant. The only thing I would say against him as a writer is that he disguised his fictionalization of his own career as accurate biography, accurate history, and accurate science. But he was terribly good at it. He was one of the most seductive writers of modern times. And all I would ask is that people read him as a rhetorician. The moment you start doing that, you begin to see the clues and the cues in his work to the self-promotion, which is simply pervasive in it.
Are you actually saying, and I put these words in your mouth a moment ago, you didn't reject them, but are you actually saying that he is a conscious falsifier?
Okay. This is actually a very tricky question. And the reason is that Freud was a highly confused man. I think from, let's say the early 1890s on, he was somewhat taken in by his own pretensions. And so it's not an easy matter to say what he actually believed and what he didn't believe. I would say that what Freud believed in most firmly was his own destiny, was his greatness. And if this greatness didn't match up with the facts would just have to get out of the way. And you would say, well, okay, it sounds like, you know, Bernie Madoff, but it's not that simple. Because in the realm of scientific discovery, it's very easy to slip over the objections and not do the right experiments and continue to delude yourself while you're deluding others.
Well, what actually is
such a simple matter?
What actually is the scientific status of Freudian theory? When you talk about Freud's work, you can talk about a number of things. You can talk about his theory, which we'll do right now. You can talk about his therapy method, which has been widely used for many years, though less commonly now, in this country at least, than was once the case. And you can also, in essence, talk about the man and his very interesting career. When we wonder about what motivated him, I wouldn't compare him so much to a Bernie Madoff. I remember, I think I've got this right, that his mother, and in the family generally, they called him Der Goldene Ziggy, the Golden Sigmund.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a much indulged child, apparently.
Well, that's true. His mother told him that he had a great destiny, and he believed it. Freud was a very superstitious man. He actually went to soothsayers, to prophets, who encouraged his belief that he was destined for greatness. But, Mild, you mentioned a minute ago that we have the question of the current status of psychoanalysis. I want to say a couple of things about that. I think the way to estimate the status of a scientific claim these days is to see how it goes over in the universities, because the universities have to be devoted to factuality. And in the realm of psychology, academic psychology, psychoanalysis is simply nowhere now.
Well, let me pick up on that for a moment. Since I am, after all, a professor of psychology, now emeritized, but I still follow things quite closely. When I was getting my training as an undergraduate, and then at Brooklyn College, and then getting my doctorate at the University of Michigan, psychoanalysis was still very much de rigueur for psychologists. Many of them were getting psychoanalyzed if they could afford it, or getting it for free under certain circumstances. But we had courses in psychoanalytic theory, and it was honored in the observance rather than in the breach. These days, in psychology departments, and I've taught in psychology departments for all of my career, it isn't really there. One guy at our department, who was in a number of departments, had multiple appointments, was still a Freudian, and indeed went to get Freudian training as a lay analyst at the Institute here in Chicago.
Right.
But he taught occasional courses on Freudian theory, but nobody else did, and people sort of looked down their noses a bit, thinking that's just not worth doing. So in the precincts of professional psychology, and of course psychiatry, it is a system not in good repute, but it still does flourish, does it not, among professors in the humanities?
Well, it flourishes in two ways. I mean, number one, among psychologists rather than psychiatrists, there are still a number of psychoanalysts, and there's still, you know, psychoanalytic theory still influences a lot of clinical practitioners.
Yeah.
What it doesn't influence is people who are interested in the experimental method, you know, in scientific corroboration and so forth. I'm looking right now at a quotation from an article of 1999 called An Empirical Analysis of Trends in Psychology in the American Psychologist, which said the following, quote, psychoanalytic research has been virtually ignored by mainstream scientific psychology over the past several decades. That would go back, you know, at least to the 70s, and certainly you can go forward and say the same thing. It's just not happening. And the reason it's not happening is that the concepts and the methods of psychoanalysis are so vague, so ambiguous, and so full of contradictions that it's impossible to conduct serious experiments using these concepts. They've just been ignored.
Now let's look at this a little bit more closely. To begin with, let me mention, interestingly, another colleague at the University of Chicago. You know him better than I do. I think you've debated him publicly, namely Jonathan Lear. He is a professor of philosophy who did a major article some years ago, I think in the New Republic, in which he argued against you and argued in favor of Freud and gave personal testimony to what psychoanalysis had done for him. There must be many other people listening right now who would give testimony, gee, psychoanalysis really did help me and put me on a better course in my life, and you can't just fault it and dismiss it when people who've profited from it are all over the place, including, quote, me, somebody might say.
This is precisely the problem. You know, people say to me, you haven't even been psychoanalyzed. How do you know anything about psychoanalysis? How can you criticize it? But my position is almost exactly the opposite. Once you've been psychoanalyzed, it's very difficult to think straight about the issues that are raised by psychoanalytic theory. People say, I benefited from this. Freudian theory lies behind it. Ergo, Freudian theory must be at least correct in at least some respects. But this is simply not clear thinking. This is not logic. Any psychotherapy whatsoever, regardless of the theory that it accompanies it, may prove beneficial for reasons that have nothing to do with the theory itself. So if you feel benefited by a therapy, you're going to be inclined to feel positive toward the theory that's supposedly behind it. But that's not the way a theory is tested. A theory is tested against other theories. You take the claims of one theory, you take the claims of all the others that you know about, and you try to devise experiments to see which is correct. If you're not doing that, then all you're doing is kind of listening to your own echo.
Can I give you the Rosenberg theory of how psychotherapy works?
Sure.
There are 100 brands or more of psychotherapy practiced in this country today. Not so much by psychiatrists who pretty much given up the so-called talking cure and instead have gone for psychopharmacology, but clinical psychologists indeed and psychiatric social workers, people of those professions are engaged and people trained to lower levels as counselors are engaged in doing something like psychotherapy. And very often they may also say that they are doing it sort of in a psychoanalytic mode or style, but lots of other competing methods for psychotherapy are there and have even more enthusiasts lined up behind them these days than does psychoanalysis. I think all of them work basically by this. If the therapist is sort of a decent person or a pleasant one or appeals to the patient, and pretty soon the relationship that develops between them, so analysts would call it the transference relationship, I think that is nonsense, but the relationship that develops between them involves a fair amount of approval, maybe even of admiration on the part of the patient towards the therapist. Sooner or later, and it might be in 6 months, it might be in 3 years, the patient facing difficult moments in his life or difficult decisions or great disappointments of one sort or another will say to himself, what would Dr. So-and-so say? Or what would Dr. So-and-so do? When I tell him about this, what is his attitude going to be? And you've got then an internalized voice of another who has your welfare more or less in mind and in heart. And you use that as a way of restructuring your experience and even your decisions about behavior. And that may very well improve your position in life and make you less unhappy than you were, perhaps even release creativity or intelligence in a way that otherwise was sort of dammed up. I think it's the internalization of the therapist that tends to produce some psychotherapeutic effect. How does that sound to you?
Okay, I find that 100% plausible. You know, I can't say, yes, it's true, because I haven't had the experience, but it seems to me to make absolutely perfect sense. But let me add something to it. The question that interests me is, how do clinical practitioners come out of their practice with such certainty that their concepts have been validated, their concepts are correct, because the progress of their patients proves it to be so? Now, I think you can just take the scenario that you just ran through, and mm-hmm. you can see from it that there's no way that a concept can be validated.
Of course.
If there is a placebo effect that is producing the good results. But, you know, in addition to that, a patient in a psychotherapeutic situation is relatively vulnerable and suggestible. It's very easy. In fact, it's difficult not to pick up the conceptual bias of the therapist and to start mirroring it and flattering it with one's
exactly.
own
exactly.
behavior. Then the therapist sees that his concepts are being corroborated, and he goes out and writes a paper about how he's cured people by the application of these concepts. But naturally,
well, look, if that is the case,
other therapists can do the same thing with equal validity, namely no validity at all, because the ideas aren't actually being tested against each other.
But now, how does this work in life with regard to what one would say to friends or students or whoever who come to you and say, I think I'm going to go into – I've got some real problems and I'm deciding to go into psychoanalysis. Would you say, no, don't do that? Or would you say
– Well, first of all, I would say, how much money have you got?
Uh-huh.
Because do you really want to keep some of it for yourself? Because for most disturbances now, cognitive behavioral therapy can address them in a highly specific way and in a relatively short term. But you know, Milt, there are people who don't really want to be cured of anything. What they want to do is have a kind of high-class sounding board for their complaints and their self-estimation. And if they have lots of money and lots of time and they want to be able to tell people that they've had the very elite kind of therapy, not this bargain basement, you know, Costco stuff, why not spend your money that way? It's none of my business. But
have you just given us an explanation of the Woody Allen phenomenon?
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes I think Woody Allen was analyzed in the womb.
He claims to still be in psychoanalysis some 25 or is it by now 30 years after he started.
It's more than that. I think it must be more like 40. Isn't he in his 70s by now?
Yes, I'm sure.
Yeah. I don't know how seriously he takes it anymore. He's made so many jokes about it, you know, that it's served him very well in that way. If it's psychoanalysis that we should give the credit to for his having married his adopted daughter, I'm not sure that's such a good recommendation.
Uh-huh. Let me come to the intellectual core of this concern about psychoanalysis, uh-huh. namely your assertion that it has no principles, no propositions, no major planks in its scaffolding of theory that have been or can be confirmed. All the same, you distrust a good deal. For you, many of those planks in his scaffold of theory are disconfirmed just by virtue of seeming nonsensical or seeming ill-designed and ill-phrased. What in psychoanalytic theory strikes you as insupportable intellectually?
Okay, well, let's talk about Freud. The essential problem with psychoanalytic theory is that it has been self-validating. That is to say that it tries to prove its own propositions by reference to further propositions that only are acknowledged within its own system. Let's take, for example, the concept of resistance. Here's what Freud said about mm-hmm. the patient's resistance to the psychoanalyst's hypothesis. He said, resistance is, quote, actual evidence in favor of the correctness, unquote, of the interpretation or the theory. In other words, if the patient doesn't like what the analyst says, that proves that the analyst is right. The concept of resistance comes into play. Or again, here's what he says. Here's what he says in the famous Dora case, okay, which was published in 1905. Quote, the no uttered by a patient after a repressed thought has been presented to his conscious perception for the first time does no more than register the existence of a repression and its severity. It acts, as it were, as a gauge of the repression's strength. No signifies the desired yes.
Yeah.
If you have a system of thought that plays by these rules, of course it's going to find confirmation everywhere. In fact, I'll just give you one more quote. Here's Freud, really at the end of his life, in his new introductory lectures, quote, applications of analysis are always confirmations of it as well. So if you illustrate the theory, you are proving the theory. And, let me say that people in my neck of the woods, the humanities, do not seem to be offended by this sort of thing.
Yeah.
They take it in stride. And I've never been able to understand that, or I guess I really haven't been able to tolerate it. It seems to me that we should be more serious about ideas than that.
I should have made clear in introducing you that, though lots of people listening know all of this already, I'm sure, that you spent most of your career as an English professor at the University of California, Berkeley.
Right.
And much of your writing is literary stuff, not only the two Pooh books, which I've loved, but a volume on Hawthorne, another on Henry James. But all the rest of it is somehow related to the matters we're presently discussing. I think your first book dealing with Sigmund Freud as such and his works and ways and his followers may have been the one titled Skeptical Engagements way back in 1986.
That's absolutely right.
And that featured some very important articles that you had published in the New York Review of Books.
Yes, starting around 1980, I decided that I really had to address the whole question of the pseudoscientific status of psychoanalysis because in my own field and in the humanities generally, there was this romance of psychoanalysis that was really taking hold at that time, and things were moving in the exact opposite direction from the way I personally was moving.
Of course, there are a number of other books of yours that all deal with Freud. Just the titles quickly, The Memory Wars, although that deals also with the question of repressed memories of sexual abuse, which was quite faddish in this country for a while, and based upon a rather misapplied or foolishly applied borrowing from Freud's theory of repression and the unconscious and so on. Unauthorized Freud is another title. Follies of the Wise is a book that you did rather recently, 2006, in which you deal not only with Freudian psychoanalysis but various other follies of equal pertinence, though probably not of equal popularity. Coming back to the scaffolding, the doctrine of repression and the unconscious, that is crucial. And a defender of, and again, the listener who may be a, quote, successful analysand or otherwise remains a Freudian enthusiast, would say to you, look, you can't deny that he gave the world an understanding of the unconscious side of the human mind and the mechanisms by which we fill the unconscious with troublemaking ideas.
Okay. Well, two things. Number one, in 1970, Henri Ellenberger, Ellenberger we call him in English, published a book called The Discovery of the Unconscious, a vast, vast scholarly work about romantic psychology, proving that ideas of the unconscious were flourishing in the 1820s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. And they were just going out of style when Freud was being trained as a doctor. And what Freud did was essentially a great revival of this tradition, essentially the tradition of mesmerism. So there was absolutely nothing new about the unconscious. But let me, and the same is true of the word repression, the textbook of psychology that Freud read in when he was a schoolboy contained the concept of repression. So it's not new. But Freud's evidence for repression was the following. He told his patients that they were suffering from such and such disabilities, mostly of a sexual nature. The patients hotly disagreed with him. He remained convinced that he was right and they were wrong. Therefore, their minds must have harbored a mechanism causing them to resist the truth that he had tried to inform them of, and that mechanism was repression. So Freud's evidence for the existence of repression boiled down to the fact that people disagreed with him. And that's it. There was no other evidence. There never was. And let me say one other thing. How do we validate the concept of repression? People come out of psychotherapy believing that it has been proven to them that they repressed things in their childhood. How did this happen? It happened as a result of the therapeutic process itself, which is to say that the concept was introduced into the therapy and the patient became convinced by the therapist that that must be the way things had happened in his childhood. And so the concept is validated. But that's not the way we seriously validate concepts, not in this retrospective way.
A question that always fascinates me with regard to any major body of theory that gets some public acclaim and which hangs around for a few generations, the question that always fascinates me is, what does that body of theory, that body of lore, do to the general sensibility of the time? What does it do to the very nature of social relationships? What does it do in the culture? What is the broader influence of, for example, Darwinism? And Freud is right. Darwin certainly stirred things up and got across some findings and some thoughts which were very unpopular with many people who encountered them, essentially because they seemed to be anti-religious. They certainly invalidated, if you took them seriously, the book of Genesis. Copernican astronomy also produced some negative responses and some alteration in the culture. All of that is background for my asking you. I think Freud is right in saying that the third one really disturbed and stirred things up with regard to the general publics of the world was Freud and the doctrine of psychoanalysis. Now, so many years later, virtually, let's see, it's more than 100 years after the first papers by Freud and Breuer, what has the lasting influence and what is the continuing influence of psychoanalysis in our broader life, in our society, in our modes of valuing, in our morality, for that matter, in our very aesthetics, et cetera, et cetera. Is this still a Freudian age?
Well, that's a tremendously, tremendously vast and complicated issue, which I couldn't really address in a concise way. But let me just say, Freud has been immensely influential. And anyone who thinks that we can now stop studying Freud from a historical point of view is just ignoring the whole 20th century. I think in cultural terms, he might be the most important figure of the whole 20th century.
What did he do? How did he affect or alter our culture? If there had been no Freud, what would be different in our culture?
Well, there's so many things, but let's put this in very, very general terms. Up until sometime near the 20th century, human beings in the West tended to look at their own behavior and the behavior of others primarily in moral terms. That is, are we virtuous or are we sinful? With the psychotherapeutic revolution, all this changed. Now the question is, what makes me feel good, and what if I feel bad, what made me feel bad, and how can I get over feeling bad? So the moral universe of evaluation is replaced by a therapeutic universe of evaluation, and this is just tremendously significant. And there's no way we're going to get away from this for a long time. I'm not even sure we should. The Christian worldview doesn't interest me very much. Maybe the psychotherapeutic worldview makes more sense, but whether or not that's the case, this is what's happened, and it's a tremendous revolution. It's not altogether Freud's doing, but it's certainly associated with his name.
How has Freudianism affected the arts, for that matter, just common philosophical, pre-philosophical thought as engaged in by professors or by their students or just by ordinary folks?
Well, let's distinguish between the effect of Freudianism on writers and the effect of Freudianism on critics of writing, because these are actually quite different. Let's take, for example, as a writer, D.H. Lawrence. When he was writing Sons and Lovers, he was studying Freud intently. In fact, his mistress at the time was very much a Freudian. She was teaching him all about it. When that happens to a writer, the writer will introduce psychoanalytic concepts into the work itself, and then these can be, studied by literary critics as if they were any other influence. But then there's a completely different dimension, and this is something that, I sort of fell for in my early days as an academic, and that is, if you think that Freudian psychology is really universally applicable and true, then you're going to expect that the unconscious influences on writers will produce symptomatic traits in their works, which you as a critic can analyze. And so then you have a what I would call pseudo-objectivity, where you are inferring goings-on in the mind of a writer by interpreting the words in his text in a psychoanalytic light. And that, that's something that still goes on in the humanities. I think it's starting to fade away a bit, but certainly in the last 30 or 40 years, it was a very big thing.
I think I've known some writers who whose work is very heavily influenced by Freud, in that they're sexually preoccupied, but always sexually preoccupied with things that shock some of their readers as edging towards perversity. For example, Norman Mailer. I knew him rather well, and I think that's very visible in some of his writing.
I think it's true of Bellow and Roth, too.
Do you? How in Bellow, for example?
Well, Bellow actually was quite interested in psychological theory, and for a while he was quite enamored of Wilhelm Reich's works, if I recall.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and Roth, Portnoy's Complaint is a kind of Freudian work in a comic vein. And just in a more general way, Roth has been a self-examining writer, someone who's looking at his own navel in a way that in the 19th century would have been unthinkable. So in a sense, Freud legitimizes this kind of literary self-inspection.
I was going to mention yet another writer whom I also knew, Jerzy Kosinski, who had a great success until it was disclosed, whether truly or with falsification, that his work had essentially been written by two people who worked for him.
That's right.
That he gave them the plots. But either way, all of those rather sparse and really startling and shocking picaresque adventure novels that he wrote involve sexual extremity, one might say.
Right.
And sexual and sadism. Sadistic indulgences.
Right.
And I know that he knew Freud. He and I talked about Freud. He got involved in asking me about Freud because he learned that I was a psychologist.
Right.
Freud is still everywhere, in other words, even if not in departments of psychiatry.
Yes, Freud is in the culture and is not going to be leaving the culture anytime soon. And, you know, people often say to me, why do you care about this stuff? Here was a great cultural figure. The only reason to care about it is that some people still take the proposition seriously, and the propositions have been pretty much disconfirmed.
Actually, you are one of a group who are on one side of what is called the Freud Wars, I think.
Yes.
You've mentioned one or two others in our conversation today, but one could easily come across 10 or 15 others who've written books essentially trying to disestablish the Freud cult.
Well, let me mention my favorite among all these books.
Yeah.
Because, you know, people often say to me, you're the leading critic of Freud. And this is absolutely false. What I've tried to do is call the public's attention to the fact that there's a scholarly tradition of, you know, Freud revisionism that goes back to about 1970. And the greatest of all these works is Malcolm McMillan's book called Freud Evaluated, The Completed Arc. He's an Australian professor of psychology, and friend of mine too, by the way, who's probably he's well into his 80s now. This book was published in 1991 in a very sloppy edition. It wasn't his fault, and he had a chance to revise it for MIT Press in 1997. I'm happy to say I wrote a foreword to it. But this is an enormous empirical study of Freud's propositions, sequentially laying out what Freud asserted and then simply asking, how true is it? What are the anomalies here? How much can we trust this? And at the end of this vast book, essentially, McMillan says, there's nothing here. There never was anything here. But it's done with such thoroughness that it never has to be done again.
Who's on the other side in terms of writers who respond critically to you and to McMillan and to all the others? If there is a Freud war going on still, who are the generals on the other side of the combat?
Well, just a whole lot of psychoanalysts, really. That's what it comes down to. I'd like to tell you that there's a big debate about the substantive propositions of psychoanalysis, but it's not true for two reasons. Number one, it's very hard to tell what those propositions are anymore. There's so many schools of psychoanalysis. And number two, the Freudian way of dealing with criticism, and this was pioneered by Freud himself, is to ignore the substance of the objections and to go straight to the personality of the objector.
Yeah, the Freudian interpretation is often an argument ad hominem.
Well, you know, there's so much ad hominem stuff. I keep reading about myself. I keep learning new things about myself in statements about my own work, saying how angry I am, how disturbed I am, how intemperate I am, and so on and so forth, how many awful problems I must have had in my own psychological development. And they never get around to addressing the propositions in my work. I'm afraid that Freud set a very bad example here, and one still sees it in psychoanalytic discourse.
Have you read the memoir that Diana Trilling did about 10 years ago now?
I did read it, and of course she and her husband Lionel were very, very deeply into psychoanalysis, the two of them.
That's why I ask, of course. Yes, they were. And she also tells about the various psychoanalysts they dealt with, many of whom were really pretty unstable people themselves, as well as very often rather unethical.
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, Janet Malcolm's book in the Freud archives has similarly comical stuff to say about, you know, the Park Avenue psychoanalysis, even though she herself is still a bit of an advocate of it. Her satirical talent can't really be suppressed, and that book is really quite funny in certain ways.
Do you want to say anything? I don't want to encroach upon author's privacy, but do you want to say anything about the book you're working on right now?
Yes. You know, when I published Follies of the Wise, which was a big thing for me, I mean, it wrapped up a lot of things in my own career. I thought I was through with Freud. I certainly was through with, trying to figure out how much basis there was for his ideas. But I realized that I was still fascinated by the man himself in the following way. Freud was trained at the University of Vienna Medical School by some of the greatest doctors of the 19th century and researchers as well. And he was trained in a kind of hard-nosed positivistic science that took nothing for granted. It was, in fact, the movement that had arisen in Germany as a reaction against the whole romantic psychology that I mentioned earlier, the psychology of the unconscious. And yet Freud, by, let's say, the year 1897, had become completely alienated from this point of view and completely alienated from his colleagues in the university, too. He had become a kind of guru who used his own personal authority as the sole basis for asserting the validity of his ideas. And that's what psychoanalysis in his hands became in the 20th century, too. It became what my late friend Frank Chaffee, the philosopher, called a testimonial science. That is, a science that you can believe only if you first believe in the good word of the founder, the guru. Now, how did a person who was trained like that get to be like this? That was the question that occurred to me. And so I've been working on a biographical study of Freud up to the time of his founding of psychoanalysis, just focusing on this one question. How did he get that way? What influences pushed him in that direction? Partly they came from his personality, of course. Partly they came from his experience. And it, even though there's a vast amount of literature on Freud, this part of his career hasn't been very much studied, so it's quite interesting to do.
One theme that often comes up in studies about Freud, including from psychoanalysts, including things that Freud himself has written about once or twice directly, otherwise by implication, is that he was in an anti-Semitic world and he had to defend himself against that, and that closed him off from his former colleagues or former professors at the University of Vienna, and he developed a defensive circle around him, except for Jung, who was supposed to represent them to the larger non-Jewish world, but then Jung betrayed him. You know that whole version of
sure.
the Freud story.
Yeah. Well, this is a very complicated subject because when Freud was a young man, there was a great liberalization going on in Vienna, and there was optimism that anti-Semitism would, if not disappear, at least become a very minor phenomenon. In the 1890s, in Vienna, things turned very, very ugly in the civic mm-hmm. government and the state, the federal government. And it's true that it became harder for Jews to get advanced in the professions. Every Jewish scientist and doctor had to make some kind of adjustment to this situation in the 1890s. Some of them converted to Christianity. Others just decided to kind of ride it out. But Freud had a personality that was extremely abrasive, defensive, suspicious to begin with, completely apart from this problem. Anti-Semitism was a real factor in his life, but he reacted to it in a way that was different from, let's say, Joseph Breuer's way, his friend Joseph Breuer, who managed to deal with it. What Freud did was to take the phenomenon of anti-Semitism and apply it to the public reaction to his own theory in a way that begged the question of whether or not the theory was correct. In other words, Freud would say to himself, "They hate me because I'm a Jew," instead of saying, "What are their objective objections to my theory and how can I answer them?"
Since I'm a social psychologist, I'm, of course, particularly interested, or was, when I was in the reading phase of my youth, in his socio-psychological works, particularly The Future of an Illusion, his book about religion, and Civilization and Its Discontents. Do you think there's any worth in Freud as socio-psychology?
Frankly, no. And the reason is that, let's take Civilization and Its Discontents. That's a book which tells us that the entire history of the human race and its struggles for peace and the antagonism between societies and so on can all be reduced to the struggle between two great instincts, the life instinct and the death instinct. This has been very impressive to some of my literary friends. It has a kind of operatic quality to it.
Particularly when you refer to them as Eros and Thanatos.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And, of course, the problem is if these concepts are, pseudo-realities, pseudo-entities, then what does that do to the theory that all of civilization consists of a contest between these two instincts? So the whole thing just kind of falls through and seems to me to be colossally pretentious and also it's a very bad example for historians, because it takes us away from the details of specific events, the actual struggles, the social class, and, competing interests and so on, and puts it all on a kind of pseudo-biological level that it simply doesn't explain anything.
What you've just said has great applicability as well to yet another literary undertaking by Freud, namely his psychoanalytic biographical studies of Woodrow Wilson,
yes,
Fyodor Dostoevsky, and Leonardo da Vinci.
Right. There are books about all of these things, and the short way of analyzing it all is that Freud always saw his own struggles in the struggles of others. It turns out that Dostoevsky, for example, didn't really have epilepsy. What he had was an Oedipus complex.
Yes.
Leonardo da Vinci was hung up on his mother. How curious, because that's what Freud was, and so on and so forth.
Well, I think one can say of Sigmund Freud I think it's Horatio says of Hamlet. No, it's what Hamlet says about his murdered father. Take him all in all, we shall not look upon his like again.
Maybe. I'm absolutely sure of that. He's one of the unique characters of history.
Yes. And you're a wonderful writer in all of your work. I've much enjoyed talking with you again, renewing an old acquaintance.
Milt, I don't want you to leave without my saying that your radio program was the beacon of rationality in the whole country.
That's very kind. And very kind for you to take the time today. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank
our guest,
you.
Our guest has been Frederick Cruz. The most recent book by Frederick Cruz, though another will appear, the one he's just been talking about, is titled Follies of the Wise, published in 2006 by Counterpoint. And with that, indeed, goodbye to all, and thanks for listening.